Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey, next on the Teen Nation, thanks for coming back and tuning in to part two of this week's show featuring my conversations with a pair of Tims. Tim Simpson, one of the all-time great ball strikers, and a former sergeant in the 82nd Airborne Division of the U.S. Army, now an assistant high school golf coach, Tim Gastel. Tim Simpson has overcome so much in his life, so many different physical ailments, so many things that have really tried to keep him down. And every time it tried, it failed because he overcame each and every obstacle. He is now fighting probably the toughest one he's ever had, but I know Tim is going to overcome this one as well. You'll hear that story here in just a moment. Tim Gastel, a wounded warrior in the 82nd Airborne over in Iraq. You'll hear that tragic story. He battled his way back from a number of injuries, fell in love with the game of golf. He and his father became the best of friends over the game of golf, and now he's a wonderful high school coach and just an unbelievable human being. You'll hear both of them telling their amazing stories. But before we get started, I want to remind you about our friends over at 2Under. 2Under men's performance briefs are the unofficial underwear of the PGA, Ryder Cup, and President's Cup teams, and are sold in over 3,000 golf pro shops and golf specialty retailers nationwide. Ricky Fowler is their global ambassador, and over 50 other PGA, Korn Ferry, and Champions Tour players wear them. Just to mention a few, they are David Toms, Jerry Kelly, Justin Thomas, William McGirt, Scott McCarron, and Chris DeMarco. The Joey Pouch technology provides the ultimate male asset management, delivering maximum comfort from the tee box to the boardroom to the bedroom. Go to 2under.com to check out the bundle specials that offer substantial discounts for being a Next on the Tee listener. That's the number 2UNDR.com. 2Under, performance in your pants.
Every January, PGA Tour Superstore pros meet every manufacturer, learn about the latest equipment, log thousands of hours of training, and together hit over 100,000 balls, all so they can get you the perfect fit.
Now back with me is one of the all-time great ball strikers, one of my all-time favorite guests, and a wonderful friend, and that is Tim Simpson. Tim is from right here in Atlanta, Georgia, played his college golf at the University of Georgia, where he lettered in 1975 and 76. During his time at UGA, Tim was named All-SEC, All-American, and a college All-Star. He won the Southern Amateur in 1976 and turned pro in 77. He won four times out on the PGA Tour at the 1985 Southern Open, the 1989 USF&G Classic, and back-to-back years at the Walt Disney World Oldsmobile Open in 89 and 90. Tim also won the Georgia Open four times. He was named the PGA Tour Comeback Player of the Year in 1989. He had two top 10 finishes in majors, both coming in 1990 at the U.S. Open and the PGA Championship. That year, he was named the Georgia Professional Athlete of the Year. In 2004, he was inducted into the State of Georgia Sports Hall of Fame. In 2006, he was inducted into the Georgia State Golf Association Hall of Fame and named Comeback Player of the Year on the Champions Tour. Over the course of his career, he had 82 top 10 finishes, 202 top 25s, and they just don't come better than Tim Simpson. Hey, Timbo, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing fantastic, Chris. It's a pleasure to be on.
So, Tim, you are one of the strongest people, not only that I know, but that I have ever heard of. I mean, you were a grinder out on the PGA Tour. You fought through injuries throughout the course of your playing career. You dealt with Lyme disease now for many years. You've had neurological problems as a result of that. You had brain surgery, and you were recently diagnosed with something else that I know you're going to be. Talk about the challenges that you've had over the course of your life.
Well, I've definitely had some mountains to climb, that's for sure. But back in the first of February, I had severe COVID and pneumonia and spent several days in our local hospital down here, Lake Oconee, Georgia. And got out and wasn't any better. It was just an act of God, I guess. I was trying to send an email to my primary care physician, and I accidentally sent it to my head investor. It made no sense. I was out of my mind, conscious, but truly out of my mind. My body was crashing, and he immediately called my son, said, "Something bad's the matter with your dad." Well, my son called my doctor buddy across the street, who's retired from surgery and teaching now at the UGA Medical School. And he immediately called his wife. He was in lecture. And his wife's a former nurse, said, "Go check on Tim." And she came across the street and found me in extreme distress on my bed, and immediately called an ambulance. I spent, I believe it was 16 days within two hospitals in Athens, Georgia. The first week I was in intensive care, pretty much unconscious most of the week. I have no recollection of anything the first week, including relatives coming to see me. I don't remember anything. I was eventually diagnosed with a highly rare form of cancer. Let me take a step back, Chris. I'm sorry. I was in total renal failure. My kidneys had quit working altogether. So it was discovered, fortunately, we had a brilliant oncologist on staff, and he discovered I have a very rare form of cancer of the bloodstream called light chain crystalline nephropathy. How rare is it? He told me I'm around the 15th person in the nation to have it. And he further told me at my last visit that there's only one microscope in the world that'll even pick it up. And fortunately, he had access to it and was able to properly diagnose it. So while in the hospital, they put a dialysis port in my chest. And I took dialysis 3 days a week for 3 hours a day. Within 5 weeks, I went from zero kidney function to 66%. So they took me off dialysis. I had my port in my chest removed 2 days ago. And I'm a happy camper because now I can hit balls. I can play with my buddies and this and that. I go to chemo every week and immunotherapy, and it zaps my strength. The only thing I've complained about since this happened to me is just give me some energy, so I've taken several iron transfusions, and they put something else in my immunotherapy that helps build my red blood cells, and I can feel that I'm getting stronger. I'm back in the gym 3 days a week, lifting, and my legs are coming around. When they sent me home from the hospital, They wouldn't let me out without taking a walker. I had to learn to walk all over again. Unfortunately, they had messed up my meds, and they had me on huge doses of steroids, which send your blood sugar through the roof. And I'm diabetic, so my blood sugar was over 500. So I couldn't see, I couldn't focus. I was very uneasy on my feet. The only way I could walk was with assistance, somebody holding my arm. And I tell you what, not being able to drive a vehicle is really something you don't want. You want to run down to Publix and grab something you need to eat, but you can't do it. And we're kind of out in the country down here. It's not like you've got access to Instacart all over the place for somebody to get it. But I'm making tremendous progress. I've been off of dialysis for 5 weeks now. My energy has come back somewhat. It's a huge improvement from where it was. I get weekly blood work done that goes very, very deep into my blood. And, I'm still very low in six or seven different areas, but I'm good in probably 10 areas. I've got about another 2 to 2.5 months of chemo. Then they're going to stop it totally and take a step back and watch approach and see how my body does. But I'm excited to get back hitting balls when the rain stops down here and playing nine holes with some buddies. Don't have all my strength back. Certainly not hitting it Scotty Scheffler long or like the kids out there today, but you know what? It's just going to be fantastic.
So with such a rare form of cancer, Tim, what is it, curable? Can they get you to a point where, you know, your prognosis is you can live as long as you want. You just got to do these sorts of things. What do they know since you're only number 15 case of having something like this?
You know what, to be honest, this may shock you, but I haven't asked them. I haven't asked them, am I stage three, stage four? What's my prognosis? You know, I'm just fighting like heck, you know, doing everything the doctors say. And, you know, I feel like every time I stop walking, somebody's sticking me in the arm to get more blood. But anyway, I'm very optimistic. My son says I was obviously out of it. That the oncologist told him that he said that he could show him a case study where a woman had beaten it and made a total recovery. I'm very optimistic. I can tell you this. I can't explain it, Chris, but I've never been at peace like this in my life. Never. I mean, I'm just totally at peace. I feel like everything's going to work out.
So what do you attribute that to? With all the things that you have dealt with in your life, to be at this stage and have the things that you are now battling against, how do you explain the peace that has overcome you?
I can't explain it. I think it's just a gift. It's just something I've had since I got out of the hospital. There's just no doubt in my mind I'm going to beat it. I don't care what the doctor said. You know, it's it's just my attitude.
Tim, you have had a long-standing friendship with Dr. Bob Rotella, one of the great mental coaches in our game. And you recently talked to him and shared with him what you're going through and what you're dealing with. Talk about what he told you.
Well, he's a dear friend, and Tom Kite and I were his first two clients in 1983. And I owe all of my success to Bob. Sorry, I'm getting a little choked up. But he told me to visualize every night and visualize the good soldiers killing the bad soldiers. And I told him that I had seen that on Dateline or 2020, 20, 25, 30 years ago, and that oncologists couldn't explain it. They could not explain the dramatic positive results they were getting with people with terminal cancer, that it just disappeared. You know, so I'm doing a lot of that, and I've got a whole lot of people praying for me. So I'm just at total peace.
And I think to take that a half a step further, visualizing and being a positive person and having a positive mindset, I think is what you're referring to, is, you know, for those folks that are dealing with things, whether it's cancer or other things in their lives, if you have a positive mindset and you tack it with that positivity, you can overcome a lot of things that people just can't explain. It's that positive energy that helps people get through some things. Is that what he's referring to with you?
I believe so. And you know, it, you know, they say even the most brilliant people on earth, a small percentage of their brain capacity. And the brain is our strongest muscle. It's not our quad. And our legs or our back muscle, you know, and it's just, I think the attitude with which we take things is so critically important. And I just choose to be totally positive. I don't let negative thoughts come into my head. It's like, you know, when I'm struggling in the gym and I've lost tremendous muscle strength, it's like, well, I'm better than I was day before yesterday. I'm stronger. I can feel myself getting stronger. My dear friend, Chip Beck, my college roommate, he came and stayed with me for a day. He had a corporate outing down at the Masters. And we're talking just 3 weeks ago. I couldn't get up my front steps without pulling myself with my arm, you know, my hand on the rail. And, you know, now there's no problem walking 2 miles. So, I mean, that's in 3 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's just my positivity.
That's fantastic. Tim, let's switch gears a little bit. Let's talk a little golf because it is PGA Championship week. Before we talk about this year's tournament, I want to go back in time with you, back to 1990. You finished tied for eighth that year in the PGA at Shoal Creek. Wayne Grady would go on to win that week. But you were in the mix all 4 days. What do you remember about being right there at the top of the leaderboard back in 1990?
I just remember what a great course Shoal Creek was and is. Unfortunately, they tragically lost hundreds of trees in a tornado a couple of years ago. But just a fabulous golf course and no let up. You know, just, I mean, if you took your foot off the gas and went to sleep for a half a second, I mean, you made a double bogey. Beautiful piece of property, a lot of undulation change. Truly a fabulous golf course. But I watched, I don't watch a lot of the PGA Tour unless, you know, a former UGA player, you know, that's a friend is around the lead. I want to see how they're doing. I watch more of the LPGA. But I did watch a lot yesterday. I didn't watch the first round. I watched yesterday's second round. And oh my gosh, Chris, I have never seen more putts made in a PGA Tour event in my life ever. I mean, they were running the tables up there. And we played the senior PGA Championship there at Valhalla when I was on the Champions Tour. And I'm like, dadgum, I wish I had about one tenth of those putts. I'd have won by five. You know? But I remember, I think it's 15 and 16 back-to-back par fours with a creek running down the side. I remember, you know, when you got to those two holes, you had to cinch up your shoelaces. I mean, very, very difficult back-to-back holes coming in. Really nice course, beautiful piece of property.
I find it amazing what Scottie Scheffler did yesterday, going out and shooting 66 with how his day began. And we talk about mental toughness, and you guys have to learn how to compartmentalize things, life on the golf course and life off the golf course, so that you can focus and be good at both things. How do you compartmentalize something like what Scottie had to deal with first thing in the morning and then go out and shoot 66?
I don't know. I mean, he's special. I mean, he's mentally, he is like just tough as granite, like steel. And, you know, that's the way Tiger's been. I remember when Tiger got on tour, and we first became friends and talking to him, playing practice rounds and this and that. The thing that impressed me, it wasn't his length, you know, because he was thin and lanky back then. You know, now he looks like an NFL defensive back, you know, he's so muscular. But the thing that impressed me, he was on another level mentally. You know, and I mean, I'd been around, certainly friends with and played with Nicklaus and Palmer and Watson and Trevino and Johnny Miller, you know, the stars of before my era and then during my era. And he was just different, you know, and I think it goes back to what we were touching on with my health, you know, is the importance of the mental side, the strength of your mind. You know, I mean, yesterday he makes triple on number two, knocking himself out of making the cut unless he has a phenomenal comeback. And he never even blinked, you know, didn't get angry, didn't bang the club. And I think Scottie has a lot of that. Obviously, he's riding on a high, you know, with winning four of the last five tournaments he's played. But I mean, it's just astounding what he's doing. He doesn't have a weakness. They say his short game is just beyond incredible. And he's a great putter. And he's number one tee to green and ball striking. It's like, well, find a weakness. Well, you're not going to find it mentally. Obviously, yesterday was evidence of that.
So looking at the leaderboard that we do have, and Scottie being right there in it, to your point, having won four of his last five, and he finished second in the other one. Who do you like this weekend?
You know, it's hard to say. I think it could very well be Xander's time. He's been, you know, he's finished second his last two events. you know, they universally say, you know, he's the best player to not have won a major. He's got a beautiful swing. I enjoy watching him, and he's a great putter. I enjoy watching him swing the club because he's long and he's not, you know, 6'3", 6'4". And you just don't really see it. It's like he generates, you know, kind of effortless power. He has beautiful balance. He's a great putter, great short game, hit an unbelievable sand shot yesterday. I think I'd go with him this week. I really would, not just because he's leading. I mean, obviously, we're just at the halfway point, but I think it's his time. And if it's not this week, it's darn sure coming. Maybe the U.S. Open. But he's a, you know, a lot like me, you know, being a great ball striker, you're going to have a lot more looks at it. He's controlling his ball incredible. I'm trying to remember his playing partner yesterday. When they asked him about his round, it was like he was just basically watching Scotty. I mean, not Scotty, Xander. I'm sorry that it was just like perfection out there yesterday.
As we look ahead a little bit, Tim, next month, the U.S. Open returns to Pinehurst No. 2. I know you played there when it used to host the Hall of Fame Classic back in the 70s and the early part of the 80s. What do you remember about Pinehurst No. 2?
A very, very fair golf course. And unlike the modern courses of today, including Valhalla, where they're playing this week, it's they talk about the 3-inch, 4-inch rough up there. You know, Pinehurst greens are more of their old style greens, what they call push up greens, you know, and you know, they're not hugely mounded, but they're pushed up 2, 3, 4 feet off the fairway level. So the thing about Pinehurst that's unusual is when you miss a green, you don't just grab a 60-degree sand wedge. I mean, you could hit 5 different clubs, no problem. You know, you could play a low chip and run. You could play it with a 60. You could play it with a 56-degree sand wedge, you know, a square face, open face, or even go down as low as a 6 or a 7 iron and play a chip and run. It opens up a multitude of what do I want to do here? I mean, it's the kind of place where a Raymond Floyd would really cut your throat because he had such a brilliant short game. And varied his shots.
Does it favor any one type of player or style of player, or can anyone win there?
I think anyone can win there, that is, as long as their short game is really sharp, you know, and they're up and down in it, because you're going to miss green because of the nature of the way they're designed there. And I think that it's going to require a lot of patience. And that's the most important thing in a major. I think that's the reason that I never had success at the Masters, was I would just get impatient and mad after the first 3-putt or 2, you know, and I was done. I think when you watch back to Xander Schauffele, I think you see a very, very patient young man. You know, it's like, this is a major. No matter what happens, I just got to keep grinding away.
You mentioned some of the great players in the history of our game, you know, Jack and Arnold and Gary and those guys. When you got out on tour in the late 70s, I kind of think of that as the golden age of golf. When you played alongside of those guys, whether it was in a practice round or in the tournament proper, what are some of your favorite stories about being, whether you played with them or you watched them play, what are some of your favorite stories about seeing those guys play back in the primes of their careers?
Well, let me use Trevino as an example. We got paired together the first 2 rounds of the 1990 British Open at St. Andrews. And then I birdied 18 and nipped him by a shot, but we wound up getting paired again on Saturday, just twosome. And I'm telling you what, Chris, Lee Trevino put on a wedge clinic for 3 rounds. It's like, now I was a pretty sporty wedge player, but it's like, this is another level. I mean, this is just crazy. And I remember the first time I was paired with Johnny Miller. He was a hero of mine, and he was past his prime. And we were on number 11 on the South Course at Torrey Pines, where they play the U.S. Open. And anyway, he hit the, it was a long par three back then. It was like 210, which was long. That was a 2-iron. And so after he hit the shot in there, it was just crazy how beautiful the shot was. I'm like, so what were you thinking there? I mean, like, what were you trying to do with the ball? He's like, I just set it up about 3 foot left of the flag and let it just fall right in there. And I'm like, what? 3 feet with a 2-iron? I'm like, damn, son, you need to go back to the range. You got a lot of work to do. You know? And then one day I was playing a practice round with Jack at Doral, just the two of us. And I don't know how we got on the subject, but Jack said to me, I mean, I took it as just an incredible compliment. He's like, Tim, you shot a heck of a lot more low numbers than I ever shot in my career. He said, you know, you shoot 64s and fives. I just didn't do that. He said, I 69 and 70 them to death. And then I got to thinking, you know, Jack's era was different. You know, 4 under won a major, you know, not 16 under or what have you. But Jack was, you know, Jack was crazy long for his era and incredibly straight. And Jack's whole thing in the majors was middle of the green, middle of the green. And then he'd dominate a par five, knock it on in two. But you look back at Jack's career and you will see a heck of a lot of 69s and 70s and very, very few 65s. Now, Johnny Miller, he was a different cat. You know, he got the lead and, you know, had the lead. And instead of trying to be conservative on Sunday, he went out and shot 63. You know, and there's another brilliant mind right there. I mean, he just had that ability to take it deep, to take it low, like Lanny Watkins.
You mentioned a moment ago a 210-yard 2-iron. Nowadays, 210 yards, those guys are hitting 7-iron, 8-iron, 210 yards. Is it amazing to you to think back to when you played and the irons that you had to hit versus what these guys are hitting nowadays?
Yeah, and I'm all about complimenting their physical and dietary routines. I mean, they work out like fiends. They all have trainers and this and that. But the bottom line is they swing the club 2 miles an hour quicker than they did 34 years ago in 1990. 2 miles an hour is 6 yards. And so, you know, you tell me how Ricky Fowler, as small as he is, or Justin Thomas, who's small, you know, how they're hitting at 320, 330. The golf ball, it's the golf ball. It's just, it is so hot. You know, it's like the Super Bowl when we were kids. You know, you hold it at your waist and drop it and bounce over your head. And then that coupled with the computer technology and club design now is the clubs are all jacked so much stronger than they used to be. I mean, a 7-iron is basically a 5.5-iron, you know, from 1990. To give you an example, the standard pitch and wedge industry-wide in 1990 was 51 degrees loft. Now that's a gap wedge. You know, most pitch and wedges are 44 to 46 degrees. You know, so at 46 degrees, you know, that's 5 degrees times 3 yards per degree. That's a free 15 yards. You know, I was always average, as you know. You know, I was known for my accuracy. And Dad taught me when I was coming up to, son, from 7-iron on down, you don't try to hit them hard. You try to hit them close. And my 7-iron from the time I was 16 till the time I retired on the Champions Tour was 155. And so when I'm watching a tournament and you know, Ricky Fowler at 5'7" or 5'8" is standing out there hitting 7-iron 200, it's something I just can't relate to. And that's another reason I love watching the women. You know, as my distances kind of overlay, computer overlay right on top of the LPGA gals, because, you know, I turned 68 last week and I've lost a lot of club head speed. And I just accept it. I play the same way I always did. You know, just hit it closer. Don't matter what the number is on the bottom of it.
You mentioned your father, Jack. He got you started in the game at a young age. I believe you're around 7 years old when you first started playing. Talk about how hard he worked and the driving force that he was so that you could go and afford to be able to play and have success back when you were dominating in junior tournaments around the state of Georgia.
Well, Dad was a very religious person, and he chose optimism and encouragement. You know, my mother was more stern. You know, she would get on me and criticize me about this or that. Whereas Dad, it was constant encouragement. You know, and I remember I'd had a bad putting day at the TPC 1 year, the Players Championship. It was TPC back then. And Dad and I were riding back to the condo where we were staying. And I'm like, Dad, if I could just putt average, I'd be the number one player in the world. And Dad said, son, you're a lot better putter than you realize. Don't you realize every player on the PGA Tour would give their left arm to be able to hit it like you? And it kind of put things in perspective, you know, that we all have our weaknesses. You know, with Nicklaus, you know, they always said he had a bad short game. Well, trust me, it wasn't bad. You know, it just may not have been quite as good as Trevino or Ray Floyd or somebody else. But Dad was a very, very positive person always, you know. And tell you a funny story. I didn't realize how bad his dementia had gotten at the end of his life. My sisters were telling me about it. And it was one Monday morning, and Dad called me, and he said, son, congratulations. I said, on what, Dad? He said, on winning the Masters. I said, Dad, I never play any good at the Masters. I don't know where you got that. But he was just a constant, he was a bright light. You know, everybody loved him. I mean, he was like a dad to all the PGA Tour players. Everybody on tour loved Dad. And he was the best friend I ever had in my life and the most brilliant man I've ever known. I wish I was a lot more like him.
Tim, in 78, I believe your first top 10 finish came at the Greater Greensboro Open. You ended up finishing 3 strokes behind Seve that week. Were you always confident that you could compete against the greatest players on tour and certainly all of the legends we've talked about? Or was that the moment? Was that the aha moment when you realized, you know what, I really do belong out here?
No, that's a great question, Chris. The qualifying school back then was twice a year. It was in June and November. And then it changed for years to just November. But anyway, I went through the June school with Curtis Strange and Wayne Levy and Jack Renner and, you know, a number of really good players that had good careers. And my first tournament was the Western Open and at Butler National outside of Chicago, really difficult course. And I was on the range, and everybody was out there. I mean, all the stars, all the guys that I just adored and followed, you know, the year before I was in the gallery following them. And I asked my caddy to lay the bag down, and I just sat down on the bag, and just I was watching Tom Watson and watching Nicklaus and Johnny Miller and Weisskopf, watching all my heroes hit balls. And I said, I can beat these guys. I'm gonna beat these guys. It's just a matter of time. I'm gonna work so hard. I'm gonna succeed. And that was the belief I had. It wasn't, maybe you could call it cocky, but it was just like, you know, my work ethic on tour is legendary, I think. That's why I've had so many back surgeries and neck surgeries and everything else. But it was like, I wasn't gonna be denied. Yes. At Greensboro, that was confirmation that, yeah, I can win out here. You know, I'm going to be a heck of a player. And believe it or not, after all these years, what I remember about that tournament is I three-putted the last two greens. Now, can you imagine that after yeah. 45 years plus? It's like, dadgummit, I was right there. I could have won this thing, and I three-putted twice on 17, 18. But no, that was a confirmation. And I I just kept working and working and working and working and just getting better and better and more top tens and this and that, and eventually won. You know, I was fortunate enough. I went to France, to Nîmes, France, and I won the 25 and under world championship at the age of 25. And I won convincingly. I won by 10 shots. And I'm like, gosh almighty, I'm a world champion now. I can do this on the PGA Tour. And I can remember how much it helped me confidence-wise in ensuing events and in contention coming down the stretch. Yeah, that was a big turning point in my career.
When you've talked about all the legends that you watched and were around, you've mentioned Raymond Floyd's name a couple of times. And sometimes I think Raymond gets lost in the shuffle amongst the Nicklauses of the world and the guys that he played against. Obviously, Raymond won major championships, but from a tenacity and from a short game perspective, I don't think he gets enough credit for the great player he was. What do you remember about competing with Raymond?
I'll tell you this. When Raymond is playing well, and especially if he's in contention, it's like everybody ought to see the look in his eyes one time. I mean, it's scary. I mean, it's like he's in a trance. And his short game was so brilliant. You know, Raymond always fought a hook, and he set his clubs up, you know, like he built his right hand grip up significantly to slow down his release. Arnold did the same thing. But he was just such a fabulous putter and short game guy. I think for your listeners, they could probably still find it on Amazon. He wrote a short game book called, I believe it's called 60 Yards and In or 80 Yards and In. And there's a lot of wisdom in that book. But Raymond was incredibly unusual, probably the only player I ever knew, a top player, that, I mean, if he was 2 inches off the putting surface, he was chipping. All the rest of us are going to be putting, you know, unless we've got to go through something. Raymond would take a 6-iron and chip it. And I tell you what, as many times as he missed, he made them. It was unbelievable how he chipped.
When I was looking back through some of the PGA Tour media guides from the late 70s and early 80s, the early part of your career, you're listed as having made a hole-in-one one season. I believe it was in 79. Do you remember your first PGA Tour hole-in-one?
I'm trying to remember. I know I had 10 hole-in-ones and went 20 years before I got my 11th, and I got my 11th and 12th within 6 weeks on the Champions Tour. I do remember I made the first, I was told it was the first, but I kind of got messed over with the deal at Muirfield on number 4. It was foggy and raining. I was first group off. There wasn't a single spectator. And, there was one marshal behind the green, and he started screaming, you know, after my ball had hit the green, and my playing partner said, I think it went in the hole. Well, the funny thing was, you got a new car. I forgot what it was, but it was a really nice car. And so I'm like, man, that's cool. I won that car, you know. And I get in, and Bob Eastwood, who won several times on tour, had made a hole in one 30 seconds before me. And wow. He got the car, and I didn't get the car. But wow. No, it's always a thrill, you know, when you make a hole in one. And so many times it comes at unexpected times. I'll tell you something really unusual. One year at Colonial in Memphis at the Danny Thomas tournament, I was paired with Jim Dent, and I was struggling to make the cut. I had shot a bad first 9 the first day. This was the second round. And it's obvious I'm not going to make the cut because I'm like even par for 8 holes on Friday. And I drive it right in the middle of number 9. And I had 153 to the hole, and I holed out a 7-iron, just hit a perfect 7-iron. And we go to number 10, and Jim's high-fiving me and everything. We go to number 10. I got 155 or 156 downhill. I hole it again, back-to-back with 7-iron.
Wow.
I shoot 31 on the back 9 and make the cut and Bob Eastwood again, birdies two of the last three to beat me in the tournament. Almost won the tournament, and there was no way I could make the cut.
That begs the question, where's that seven iron?
Yeah, I'm telling you. I wish I could hit it like that now. I've never heard another tour player say that. You know? And I'll tell you how straight I drove the ball. I went from number eight at Bermuda Dunes, Bob Hope Classic, which was like the third term of the year in 1983, to the opening tee shot of the Tour Championship at the Harbor Town, the last tournament of the year, without hitting a ball out of bounds. Now, wow. I played 32 tournaments. Times, you'd have to say I made 85% of the cut, times four rounds, times 14 holes. I got to get somebody to figure it out. I'm not that smart. But I mean, the hundreds of holes I played without hitting the ball out of bounds. And Chip and I were talking about that when he came and stayed with me. He's like, that will never be broken. I don't care who it is. It will never, ever, ever be broken. You know?
No doubt.
Yeah. And when I did hit one out of bounds at the Tour Championship, my caddy stood there like he'd seen a ghost. It was a tee ball, number one. I said, give me another ball. And he just stood there like he was frozen. I said, give me another ball, Todd. He said, I've never seen you hit a ball out of bounds. I said, I hadn't hit one out in 6 years, but give me another ball. Oh, man.
When I look back at those old PGA Tour media guides, it lists your hobbies as music, fishing, dog training, cars, and motorcycles. I know about the fishing part. Tell me about the music, dog training, cars, and motorcycles.
I've changed a lot. Back when I was younger on tour and had no fear of anything, I had a Harley, and I figured it wasn't real healthy for my career, so I got rid of it. But my first dog I had as a PGA Tour player was a Bull Mastiff.
You know, wow.
He weighed 155 pounds, and it was just such a blast training him. And I love training my dog that I have now. He's a little guy. He's only 81 pounds. But you know, I was an avid fisherman in the 80s, fished every spare chance I got, used to fish a lot with Payne Stewart. He loved fish. And then I picked up a bow for the first time, and I just fell in love with archery. And I compete in archery and love to bow hunt, this and that. I shoot traditional archery. I shoot recurves and longbows. I don't shoot the compounds with all the sights and everything. And I pretty much shoot every day. And I may only shoot 5 or 10 arrows, but, you know, it's kind of like putting or chipping. You want to stay sharp. But I was so disappointed when I got home from the hospital. My lightest weight bow I have out of like 20 bows, I couldn't even begin to pull it back. And so it was like huge thing for me to be able to finally pull my bow back again and shoot, which means, you know, obviously I'm getting stronger, you know, but I had so much big muscle atrophy, you know, laying in a bed for 16 days. I mean, it's pretty astounding how quick your body deteriorates.
Tim, you mentioned Payne Stewart, and this is the 25th anniversary of his win at the U.S. Open in 1999. What do you remember about Payne?
He was a dear friend. I remember just perfect rhythm. I mean, Payne swung the golf club like Sam Snead. It was just magnificent, you know, and he had a set of hands from God. What he could do with a sand wedge around the greens, Payne never played a 60 degree sand wedge. Neither has Tom Watson. Neither did Greg Norman. These are guys that were just masters with their hands. I mean, I think Payne could have been a brain surgeon. He had such incredible hands. I miss him dearly. I mean, it's been years and years and years, but it was a tragic death. He would have gone on to win so many more tournaments.
You mentioned Sam Snead as well. And Sam is a guy who was competitive out on the PGA Tour well into his 60s. And you talk about the Greater Greensboro Open. I don't even remember how many times he won that tournament, 8, 9 times, something like that. Yeah. He was something even, like I say, even into his 60s. Did you get to spend some time with Sam?
Yeah, I'm one of only two players that Sam worked with on the PGA Tour. The other was JC Snead. And JC told Sam early in my career, you got to see this kid hit a golf ball. You ain't never seen nothing like it. And he's out there waiting on him to open at 7 a.m. and they got to run him away at dark. And JC had an accident and he broke his wrist. And he called me and said, you won't like that course where they're playing next week. Come up here to Virginia and help me bale hay. So I said, okay. So, I mean, he was like a big brother to me. And so he said, bring your clubs. Unky's going to be in town. That's what he called Sam. It was his uncle. He called him Unky. And so anyway, I take my clubs and I'm up there working my fanny off, helping JC bale hay. And we're in there, we're getting ready to eat dinner, and the phone rings. Of course, there's no cell phones back then. And JC hands me the phone, and I said, hello. And he said, Timmy, this is Sam Snead. How you doing, son? And it was like talking to one of the apostles, you know? and he said, you want to play golf in the morning? And I'm like, hell, I go play right now in the pitch black with you, you know? So anyway, I played with him, and for whatever reason, he just fell in love with me. I was like a grandson to him, and I would work with him. And I remember driving all the way to Palm Beach, like 10 hours, where he had a winter home down there at Pine Tree. I think it's Pine Tree Country Club. Anyway, famous club course down there. But I remember going down there and working with him, and then the next week, I think, was Bay Hill, and I had a rough week putting, but it was like, oh, my gosh. I mean, I hit it like you just had to see it to believe it, you know, after working with him. But he was so simple in his teaching. A lot of it was common sense. You know, he would tell me, he'd say, Timmy, the golf swing is like a waltz. It's na, 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 na. He'd say, son, it's not rock and roll. You know, your timing's off. You're swinging too hard. And I'd slow my swing down and boom, go out there and make a bunch of money. And it was like, man, this Sam is right. You know, but yeah, he was a wonderful, wonderful man. And anybody that you've ever heard that said, isn't it a shame he couldn't teach? Trust me, he could teach. He could teach.
Tim, just a couple more before I let you go. And along those same lines, you were such a great iron player. All of our folks listening, is there a tip that you can give us? Maybe guys and gals are listening on their way out to the golf course this weekend to go play. Is there a tip you can give us that we can keep in the back of our minds that can help us be a little bit better ball striker than we are today?
Two things. The legs, the lower body initiates the downswing. They say 90% of amateurs slice the ball worldwide. And it's because they come over the top, because they start with their hands and arms from the top. If you make sure you start with the legs, the club will drop on plane, you know, more consistently. And the other thing that I was able to do, Bob Rotella told me one time, he'd never met anybody that did it better, is when I took one step from the putting green toward the first tee, there was no more conscious thought. It was 100% target and scoring. So my tip would be for amateurs, regardless of their handicap, I mean, even fantastic, you know, college players or whatever, is get into your target. Because going back to what we talked about earlier with the mind, you know, you can be lined up 30 yards right, but your mind knows where that target is if you're focused enough on it. And it'll figure out a way to get it to the target, you know. You know, you think about, I've had Major League Baseball player friends throughout the years. And, you know, some were pitchers. And they were telling me, it blew me away. They were like, you know, forget about the strike zone. I'm throwing at an aspirin. I'm trying to hit a spot the size of an aspirin. And that's how I was with my focus. I had an ability to hyper-focus, which is highly rare for a kid that grew up very, very ADHD. But, you know, in the early mid-60s, they said, man, look at that energy. That kid's all boy. You know, they didn't put you on Ritalin or Adderall. They weren't did it back then. And I somehow learned to be able to hyper-focus to the point that I don't aim at a tree 230 yards away. I'm aiming at the one discolored leaf on a certain limb.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's just the way my mind works. It helps me in archery and in hunting because you got to narrow your focus to hit exactly, you know, like an aspirin size place, like the baseball pitcher. So my tip for anybody and everybody would be to not think mechanics on the golf course, but to narrow your focus and just trust that your brain will get it there. Now, as Bob Rotella says, we work a lot on train and trust. So you and I train, Chris, on the practice facility, you know, and you're working on, well, I'm a little over the top. I need to drive harder with the legs from in the transition, or I'm sucking it inside on the backswing. Whatever it is you work on, you know, when you take one step towards that first tee, you have to cut that car engine off. And then your only thought is target and scoring. And if you have a bad day, I had days where I hit the ball bad, and certainly, and you go to the range and you try to figure it out. You go out the next day and shoot 65.
It's interesting that you tell these stories, Tim, you know, focus small, miss small. I just heard a story about Ben Hogan going out to play a round of golf at a course that he was unfamiliar with. And he steps on the first tee and he asks his playing partner, all right, where's my target here off the first tee? And the guy says, well, look at that clump of trees, those pine trees down there, that there were five trees. Aim at those. And he's like, which one of those trees?
Absolutely.
The one in the middle. Okay, but what part of that one in the middle?
Yes.
That's how hyper focus, and it's very similar to what you just said.
Yeah, I would have said, okay, I'm going to hit it at the third limb from the bottom, the tip of it, out on the right side. You know,
wow.
It's just the way I've always been, and I don't understand it growing up so ADD. You know, but anyway, I just have that ability, and I have the ability to turn any conscious thought off about mechanics. I was helping a really, really good player last summer that came to me for help. And he's like, I can't hit a ball without thinking six things. And I'm like, just trust me, just focus your target. I would say the opposite. You can't hit a ball because you are thinking six things. You know, you want to quiet the mind, let the eyes or the laser missile sighting system, so to speak. You know, you're focused in, and back to Raymond Floyd we talked about earlier. Let me tell you what, when he'd go in that trance, you should have seen his eyes when he looked at a target. I mean, it was scary. And there's another great example of unbelievable concentration.
Well, Timbo, before I let you go, you know you're one of my favorite people on this planet. I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your day to come back and be a part of the show and to share all the stories about your playing days and let us know about the things that you are challenged with life right now. And I know there's nobody on the planet that can beat the things that you've already beaten. So I'm confident you're going to beat this thing too. I can't thank you enough for your time. I can't thank you enough for being the person that you are and how much you mean to me.
Chris, I appreciate it. I always enjoy doing the show, and I'm going to keep fighting. I got a lot of bulldog in me. There's no quit, and I'm going to beat this stuff.
I know you are. There's no question in my mind. If anyone was going to beat it, Tim Simpson's the guy that's going to do it. Take care, my friend.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
That is the great Tim Simpson, folks. They just don't come better than that guy. How many things has he overcome in the course of his life, maintained a very positive attitude, kept moving forward, and continued to achieve, whether it was on the PGA Tour, the Champions Tour, or in life. Comeback Player of the Year on both tours, on the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour. Any doubt he's going to beat this thing? Of course there isn't. Tim wouldn't stand for it. He won't allow it. Of course, every berry that's been placed in front of him, he has beaten, and he's going to do it again with this one as well. I love that guy. When you think about who he is and what he is made of and how he has been knocked down, but he's not staying down, he gets back up, dusts himself off, and keeps moving forward. That's one of the many things that I love about Tim. But he is an unbelievable player back in the day. He's a fantastic instructor. Because he's such a great ball striker, people continue to seek him out to kind of pick his brain and learn how he did it. I'm excited that he's doing it again. One of the great pleasures I get is when I either get a text message or a call from Tim to let me know that he is going out and he's hitting wedges or he's hitting his irons. That makes me so happy to know that he is back out there swinging a golf club, because few did it better than he did. He's, like I say, just a wonderful man. And somebody that I cherish to an extent that words cannot do justice to. And I look forward to catching up with him again very, very soon. Okay, coming up in the final segment of this week's show is former sergeant in the 82nd Airborne Division of the U.S. Army, Tim Gastel. Before I bring Tim into the show, let's talk about our friends over at Squares Golf. And folks, do you sway and you're off balance in your golf swing? You know what? It could be your shoes. A golf shoe needs structure to provide stability and reduce sway. How can you tell if your shoes lack structure and are hurting your game? If you can hold your shoes by the toe and heel and twist it, toss it. Squares was designed for the perfect balance of structure and comfort. Isn't it time you tried Squares? Try the new Speedbolt at squares.com. That's squairz.com.
Frustrated with your golf game? Imagine playing with total confidence. Join me, LPGA Pro and golf mindset expert Debbie O'Connell, for my Conquer Your Golf Mind Challenge. Bill cuts 6 strokes and Lori is club champion. What's your goal? Click the link or text NEXT to 727-339-0106. Use code NEXT for $20 off. Your tee time for transformation is now. Will you take the shot?
Now next on the tee with me is Tim Gastel. Tim is a former sergeant in the 82nd Airborne Division of the U.S. Army. He was wounded in the line of duty, which we'll touch on here in just a few minutes. Tim is a military hero who we all owe a debt of gratitude to for his bravery and for defending our freedom. Following his military service, he went back to school and graduated with his Bachelor of Arts degree in History and Social Studies, earning his composite teaching certificate. He went on to earn his Master of Arts in Curriculum and Instruction. Tim has been a head golf coach for several years. He is now an assistant high school golf coach at South Lake Carroll High School in South Lake, Texas. He is also a professional caddy and a member of the Veterans Golf Association. And I couldn't be more excited that I get to have him with me this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Tim, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, how's it going? It's so awesome to be on the show. I've been listening for years. I've been a fan for years. Love following you on Twitter, and just really honored to be able to speak with you. You know, it's not every day you get to speak in the golf world like this, and so I'm honored to be here.
Well, I appreciate you very much, Tim. So, but let's start talking about your military background. Let everybody know about, you know, the 82nd Airborne and your time in the U.S. Army.
Okay, so it's kind of a crazy story. About August 2001, I decided to I was going to join the Army after some hesitation, going back and forth with possibly going to college, and ultimately I decided I was going to do it. And then the day that I ended up picking, just randomly, was September 11th, 2001, and so as you can imagine, getting on an airplane that day was not something that was possible. I attempted in San Antonio to take off, and we were meant to go out and you do your swear-in at the military entrance processing station, and it's called MET. And you go in there and you do 2 swear-ins, and I did my first swear in, and we went back into a room and we watched the second tower get hit live on the TV in front of just a room full of people who were all about my age, you know, a few older guys, but they were all joining the military. They were going to the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Coast Guard. You just had a room full of people, and our country just got attacked on live national television. And you can just imagine there were some concerns about, you know, the what our country was going to look like. Anybody in that room that pretty much had decided to join based on, you know, I wanted college money. You know, there was a lot of people who didn't come back the following day. It took about 4 days for me to finally ship off to my unit. But ultimately, I decided that whether our country had gotten attacked or not, it was in my best interest to go. I needed to go. I needed to serve my country. And it didn't seem like this was anything that would stop me from doing that. In fact, I knew that at this time, probably our country needed more people. And so it was just one of those things I had to do. And about 4 days later, I ended up in San Antonio with about three people out of a group of 13 that had originally been slated to go to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And that's where I went to basic training. September 16th, 2001, we arrive in Oklahoma, and that's where it all started. And about a month into there, you know, I'm getting the advice from drill sergeants that are pretty much saying, oh, you're joining the 82nd Airborne, then you can pretty much guarantee that you're going to be going to Afghanistan. And we kind of all, you know, sitting there not really believing drill sergeants or thinking that maybe the war would be over. And then realizing not too long after that, it was probably 6 months, I'm walking off the back of a C-130 with another guy that was in that same basic training unit. And we're walking off boots on the ground in Afghanistan. And so it was definitely an awakening for me, it was like a difference between my childhood and being an adult. There's like a clear, defiant line for me, because, you know, the day you walk off an airplane in Afghanistan is kind of life changing. I realized all those days that I kind of blew off homework and lectures and class assignments, that this was kind of like a reality check. And it was good. I tell people all the time that I probably needed the Army a lot more than the Army needed me. So I got to the 82nd Airborne, and within a few months, we were getting ready to deploy to Afghanistan as part of a artillery unit that was deploying. We ended up setting up our guns in Afghanistan and then kind of just doing other things that we weren't really trained for, but in Afghanistan and Iraq, you kind of have to do that. So that's kind of what I did for my time. And I was a cannon crew member, so I worked in artillery, but you know, most of my time we were doing other things, driving through route clearances and checking roads and setting up different stuff. My unit was the first unit to build a fire base in a combat zone since Grenada. So that was kind of interesting. You know, all these things to be said, it led me to finding where I'm at now as being a history teacher, is all those lessons I didn't learn in high school, I learned in Afghanistan and I learned in Iraq. And I retaught myself things that I should have taught myself the first time. And so it was one of those things that, for me, it is definitely a defining events of my life, but in a positive way, and that they've motivated me every day since I've been out of the Army. I needed the Army. I don't know if they needed me. I don't know if I contributed. I don't call myself a hero. And I tell people all the time, I know a bunch of heroes and I've met a bunch of heroes. I'm definitely just somebody who needed the Army a lot more than the Army needed me.
You were actually wounded in Baghdad by a roadside bomb. Shrapnel went into your back, and we're all fortunate that you survived that. You were awarded the Purple Heart. Talk about what happened.
Yeah. So he, you know, it was a really quick, like I said, we went to Afghanistan first, and then as soon as we, Iraq hadn't even kicked off yet. This is back in 2003, 2004 era. And we were in Afghanistan, and my unit at that time had already was receiving the possibilities that we may just go straight from Afghanistan to Iraq because we were already there, we're already ready. And then whatever happened, you know, whoever decided that wasn't a good idea said no. We ended up coming home and then deploying almost the exact same time the year before. So August the next year, we're back in, you know, in that rotation, and they are talking about training us in mortars and stuff because they may not need artillery there because it's urban combat. But they ultimately decide that they're going to bring a artillery unit in, and we end up flying into Iraq. I go ahead and volunteer to go early, and we go and set up the fire base. And then my unit arrives. And just because I happen to be somebody who I'm kind of a, you know, I volunteer a lot, and I've always been told to volunteer. That's how you get ahead in life. You want to be active. And I've just always been one of those people that I'm not just going to sit and wait. So I volunteered to be on the first trip, and we ultimately go, and we're doing, we're basically bringing prisoners from one unit, one base, and bringing them to Baghdad International Airport, where there's a prison there. So we ultimately bring a prisoner up there on September 10th. We come back, and the next day they're like, hey, or I'm sorry, that was September 20th, 2003. And then September 21st, they're like, instead of, we were supposed to rotate who ends up deploying out and going on all the missions and stuff, but because my group had just went and knew the route, they were like, let's go ahead and let y'all go again. So we ended up going again. And to be honest, everybody in that group, we wanted to go because there was a little treat if you got to Baghdad International Airport, and there's actually really good food. Brown and Root was serving food, and you could actually eat a good meal. So pretty much all of us were on board with doing that mission. And so we signed up. It was four section, got to go again, and we were driving down, and we drove down a road into a city, and then we came down a road called Ambush Alley, which I learned later is what the nickname of this road was called. Two IEDs were on the side of the road, and we were pulling security. So as my truck was driving to get to the front of the convoy, the IED was set off, and I took two pieces of shrapnel to my lower back. It threw me up on the gun, knocked the air out of me, and it was almost just like, you know, if you've ever watched any kind of war movies where it's kind of just slow motion sounds, that kind of deal, it kind of rocked me a little bit. But ultimately, I ended up pulling security all the way back to the gate. We had a Jamaican guy that was with us, and I always love this story because you can tell when something bad happens where people are at in the world, and this guy was not ready to have a bomb go off in the back of the truck with us. And so he was freaking out. And when I showed him my back, typically when you have somebody who's injured, you don't want to scare them by saying, oh, this is really bad. But he proceeded to tell me how bad it was, and how much blood I was losing, and trying, not doing a good job of telling me that I would be okay. But ultimately, I got back to the aid station and MEK, and they flew me out and flew me to Baghdad. And I actually wrote a story that got published in a book with Andrew Carroll called War Letters, where it's basically, well, War Letters is his first book, but the book that I got published in has this whole detailed out and kind of crazy story to even mention that, because I got into that when I got back from Afghanistan, or got back from Iraq. My first sergeant didn't know what he was getting us into, but he sent me and another guy to a writing workshop, and just ended up being one of those things that no one knew what it was, and ended up being something that was really cool for me, because my story got selected. And out of about 10,000 stories that were sent and submitted. And so Operation Homecoming is the name of the book. And my story got published in that book about 2006. So right as I got out of the Army, Andrew Carroll published my story in that book. So it was kind of cool to be able to share that story. But one of those things that you don't realize is like me being able to share that story was kind of therapeutic and not bottling it up and having issues when I got back to Austin. That I think it kind of was good for me to share that story. And another reason why I, you know, am okay with, you know, talking to you about it now is because the more that people feel okay sharing those stories, I think the better they are instead of bottling them up and not being okay, you know, and having all those bad thoughts and not being able to bring them, you know, out, you know. So I appreciate you letting me talk about it.
Absolutely. What an amazing story. And Tim, when you got back to the States in 2004, you and your buddies decided to take up golf, not a sport I would have guessed someone with a tremendous amount of back pain would be looking to take up. Why golf?
Yeah, so I'm really competitive. I was a football player, ran track. My dad tried to get me to play golf when I was younger. I did a lot of putting and chipping and pitching the golf ball, but I go to the driving range with him. But where it really happened is when we were when I was in Afghanistan, I got to hit a 7-iron off of a mountain. And I remember I hit a couple golf shots, and my roommate back in the States, it turned out he was a superintendent before he joined the Army. So he worked at a golf course, and he was, you know, one of those guys that worked at a golf course so he could play golf. And I learned that in Afghanistan, but, you know, it was a couple months before we got back, and we kind of started talking smack to each other about who could play better. And I had never actually played a full round of golf, but I just felt like I had no problem hitting a golf ball, and I was pretty competitive and thought, you know, we get back to the States, I'm definitely going to beat you. And so it actually took coming back from Iraq before we finally got, I bought my first set of golf clubs. That day I bought them in Raleigh, North Carolina, or no, I'm sorry, out in Pinehurst, North Carolina. I went to a golf shop in Pinehurst because I was in Fayetteville. And we drove down there. I bought my golf clubs and I called my dad up. And that was the first time me and my dad became friends, is that phone call. Like before that, we were just kind of, I was his son and we had pretty much nothing in common. And the day I called him up and I said, "Hey, Dad, I just want to let you know, I just bought my first set of TaylorMade racks, brand new $700 clubs." And from that moment on, we just became best friends because we had the game of golf. And so I got really into it in that moment. But my buddy, who was really good, turned out he was really good. He would kick my butt. And if you know, you know, I'm sure you know this, but when you got somebody who's a friend who's better than you, you are just going to try your hardest. So for a couple months there, we kind of went back and forth. And, you know, I didn't even know how bad I was back then, now that I look at it, but I really just loved playing against him. And then when I came home, me and my dad started playing. And it's funny that I get to talk to you right now, because earlier I was online with another group where we're trying to save Lyons Municipal Golf Course. And that golf course happened to be the golf course that my dad took me to when I got back. And I was home for good in Austin. And I owe it so much. It was affordable. It had history like you can't believe. Ben Hogan played it, Ben Crenshaw, you know, all these famous people. And my dad happened to give me the Little Red Book. And if you know about Texas golf and you know about Harvey Pinnock, then the Little Red Book is like the holy grail to a golfer. And this book opened my eyes, and I'm a history major. So I just fell in love with the game of golf. I bought my first set of clubs in North Carolina, and coming home to Austin and then falling in love with Austin golf, it was just incredible. In fact, one of the girls right now that's playing for the Cardinals, up in, Stanford right now, Sadie Engelman. She was like 12 years old, and she broke the course record at Austin Country Club. And I was just getting into golf, and I'm reading these stories about Austin golf and all these amazing people who are playing golf in Austin. And I was home in Austin. It took me a long time. I was, you know, struggled through Afghanistan and Iraq, and I finally got back to Austin, and I was dealing with the pain in my back, but I was getting hooked on golf. And it was almost like the pain in my back, I didn't care about it as much as I cared about getting better at golf. So if it had to do with getting better at golf, then my back would have to take a back seat to me worrying about it. And so it really just changed my whole life. I fell in love with this game. I also met my wife, who, you know, yeah, other wives, you know, people say that other wives are supportive of golf and stuff and them playing. But my wife totally understands that I got to play golf, and she is 100% supportive of it. And she knows, and she sees it, and she supports it. And so when you have that support, and you know you do, then when you go do these things, like, I've gotten to do so many amazing things. And we always joke, because it's always a new once in a lifetime opportunity. And those things happen so much, because I'm just like really the most lucky guy out there. I could have been massively injured in Iraq, and I wasn't. I could have come home and let that injury do a lot of damage to me. And I found this crazy game. And I know it's a crazy game. People talk about, there's other things that you could be doing in the world. But man, there's something about hitting that perfect chip shot or that pitch shot. And I know that I'm talking to a golfer, so I know you know that feeling. But it's just one of those things that, for me, coming home and dealing with PTSD and issues like that, I got sucked into dealing with golf so fast that I didn't let PTSD affect me, and I didn't let things, they did, and inevitably, you know, a lot of those things affected me, but ultimately golf always brought me back, and it gave me this career. I'm now a high school golf coach. I'm now in Southlake, which I could, you know, do a whole segment on how amazing this opportunity is. And how it really is just another crazy coincidental, like, how lucky it was that I am here in Southlake, because my wife tells me one day, she calls, I have my dream job in Cedar Park. I'm going to be a head golf coach, or I am the head golf coach in Cedar Park, and life is good, and, you know, can't go wrong. And then she tells me there's an opportunity in Fort Worth, and, you know, a lot of people might be like, well, I have my dream job, I want to stay here. I've always told her I wanted to live in Austin. I thought that was where I was going to retire. But, you know, ultimately, I can be a high school golf coach in the state of Texas anywhere. That's how my certificate works. You know, like, it doesn't matter where in Texas, I can teach anywhere. That's how it works. So to deny my wife the opportunity for a dream opportunity, I couldn't do it. So I said, you know, let's just go ahead and see where this goes. And then it ends up being such a blessing to come to Southlake. And, you know, I don't want to ramble too much on about things, and I don't know how much time I have, but Southlake was, my dad passed away. And then that summer we moved up here to DFW. And my dad is like my rock when it came to golf. And then I found Southlake. And when I tell you that in Southlake, they're doing it different, I mean, they're doing it different. It's a different program here. They run it different than any other high school golf program in the state of Texas. My two head coaches, like, some people would say, well, man, you left your head coaching job to be an assistant golf coaching job. Don't you feel like, you know, you took a step backwards in your career? And no, when I say no, I mean, no, capital N-O. I took a big jump forward, because the two coaches I work for are so good, so knowledgeable. I mean, honestly, you could have both of them on your show here, and both of them could give you enough material to talk about for days, because they're both tapped into junior golf. Nobody in Southlake is waiting for people to show up to be in our golf team. You know, like, some programs, you wait for for 4 years for a move-in to come in, and you hope that they can play golf, and maybe you have two or three of those, and oh, you got a chance to go to state. Well, in Southlake, they are just building little dragons, and those little dragons become big dragons that their goal is to go to state every year. And so I got here last year, and I've only been here 2 years, and I've already been to three state golf tournaments. And it's just such a testament to what Coach Glenn and Coach Martin have created up here. And it's crazy to think that I get to be a part of it. So, I'm very blessed to be part of the golf world and however I can be. I've watched some of my high school companion, my cohorts are now going, up to college and coaching. And honestly, I don't want to leave Southlake. If I could stay in Southlake for till I'm, ready to retire, I will be here. And if the day I have to leave Southlake, I'll be a better golf coach because I got to come here and learn from these two coaches. My two head coaches both have just their own accolades. Like sometimes you hear the old saying, like those who can't do teach, and those, you know that saying?
Yeah.
In this case, it's two people who did do and now came back to kind of like bring others to that level. So they both played college golf at one played at Texas Tech, Coach Glenn played at Texas Tech, and Coach Martin played at SMU and Oklahoma City University, two-time All-American. She's going to be the first high school golf coach that the PGA of America allows to get her Class A membership for being a golf coach in our program, because our program, we have the indoor space, and she petitioned the PGA of America to allow her to be able to get her Class A, which means it's kind of opening the door for me to get my Class A, which I used to have that as a dream until I realized a high school golf coach didn't need it, and PGA of America didn't really care if high school golf coaches have that credential. Well, now I'm like seeing this coach who's doing this, and she's passed her PAT, and she's on her way to getting it. And Coach Glenn had his PGA Class A before back in the day, and when he was, in the program for that. And just the pedigree from these two people has just been so amazing to watch. And I can't stress enough how much I've learned and feel like just a better golf coach, a better golfer myself. You talked about the VGA, the Veteran Golf Association, has been such a cool thing to be a part of, to be able to go play golf and kind of like a tournament tour setting. Just really cool. I played this last week, last weekend, and I won my division, and I beat the national champion, the reigning national champion in my flight. I am in a different flight, but I'm not playing straight up. Unfortunately, I'm playing in a different category, but still, for where I'm at, I'm very happy with it. So it's just exciting. I love being in DFW. Golf in Texas, really awesome. The history of Texas golf is really cool. I get to be in a lot of cool places here. Thanks to, being in Team 43 with President Bush's group, I've gotten to do a lot of amazing things. And so it's just been really, cool to be a part of that stuff. I just want to continue to be a part of golf. My goal in life is to caddy on tour. I've gotten some really cool opportunities. I've gotten some just cool opportunities to play with. I played golf with Scott McCarron. He's my favorite champion tour player.
Is that right?
He's such a great guy. I want a trip. I don't know how I got so lucky. It was kind of crazy. I won a trip with a sunscreen company, and I had gotten really badly burnt when I was in Iraq. It was a funny story. So I wrote this story about how I'd gotten really badly burnt, and I don't know how, but my submission got us picked. So me and three of my best friends and my dad got to fly to Vegas and play golf with Scott McCarron. And since then, I have been just a huge fan of his. We played 4 days or, you know, 3 days in Vegas and played 1 day with Scott. You know, he was getting ready for the tournament at the time for the Justin Timberlake Shriner Open. So he's just been a really good supporter since I've been there. And, you know, those opportunities to get to meet those guys have been really cool because they motivate you. You know, they motivate you to play better. They motivate you to have a purpose. And these are things that I think are like help me in my therapy, my recovery. You know, Scott McCarron doesn't know that round of golf with him will forever be something that I hold on to because I was a golf with my dad. He's not with me anymore. And it was just for him, my dad, to get a trip to Vegas because his son wanted to go and play golf with this professional golfer. It was just one of the coolest events. And, you know, my best friend was, both my best friends were on that trip and they're both like, you know, it's to this day, we talk about stuff from that trip. And it's just those kind of events don't happen if I don't find the game of golf. I could go on. There's several times I've gotten to do things that you wouldn't get to do if you didn't even care about golf. They probably wouldn't even be that cool to you. But because I've gotten to do them, they've been this like, you know, purpose. I have a purpose where, you know, when you get out of the military, sometimes you don't have that purpose anymore. You don't have those kind of feelings that you were kind of bigger than yourself. And then getting to do some of these events and getting to be a part of these organizations, up here in DFW, I'm part of the North Texas Warrior Golf Association. It's doing amazing things where we're literally, you know, bringing the game of golf to some vets and then like setting them up with golf equipment and setting them up with, the available round of golf once a month, kind of celebrate that camaraderie. All these things don't happen if I don't find the game of golf. And I think about that. I think about my career. I think about, you know, when I volunteer, it's part of golf. When I'm doing my own thing, it's golf. When I'm at work, it's golf. Like, I am just so lucky that I somehow figured out that in order, you know, it's the old saying, find something you love to do and you'll never work a day in your life. Well, it's true for me. I literally go to the golf course every day. Like, I go to the golf course every day, every single day. Every day I chip golf balls. Every day I putt. I don't get tired of it. I'm not tired of it one time. You know, when I get done with work, I'm jumping on Zoom calls and having Ben Crenshaw call me Sarge on the Zoom call it's surreal moments like that where I know that the game of golf has given me so much, and that's why it's okay for me to give so much back to those who are continuing to try to, you know, bring the game of golf to, you know, help other vets. And, you know, we're going to have an influx of veterans who are going to get out in the next 10, 15 years, and they're going to be just as lost as I was 20 years ago. So my goal is to help those guys. You know, I used to always tell people that my goal in life was to bring people to the game of golf. I was like, that's going to be my mantra. I can bring people to the game of golf. As a teacher, I realized though that my goal, it kind of shifted in that my goal is not necessarily to bring people to the game of golf, but to bring people to their golf. Like, what does that look like? What makes you so into something that you are willing to like stop what you're doing and get better at it, right? What does that look like? Do you want to sing? Do you want to play the guitar? Something that you can do, and then that is going to be your thing. And you don't have to define yourself by your career, but you can define yourself by this passion that you love, you know. And I love that I get to be so involved in golf. I get to be involved in junior golf, get to be involved in professional golf in some aspects of my life. I know professional players and I've gotten to do some cool things. So it's just, I think it's having a purpose and having that next mission. A lot of vets need that. And I'm glad I found mine. So appreciate you.
Absolutely. So
Tim, one more before I let you go, and I want to go back to something you mentioned a little while ago. Lyons okay. Municipal Golf Course, I know, is very special to you. And you talked about being on some videos for Save Muni. Talk about what we need to do in order to save one of the great historic courses in the state of Texas.
Yeah, so one, we're part of, I'm part of the Save Muni board with a lot of great people in Austin. And there's a lot of good things happening right now. But what we really need is we need the University of Texas and we need the city of Austin to realize that that space isn't something that is just that we're just going to like turn away from and let them develop. Like, we're not going to let them just take it over and build up condos. It's not a space that can even handle that setup and that kind of development. And we actually need it to stay as a park system, and we need it to stay as an 18-hole golf course, because that's what it's meant for. And we could talk about the different things that are available in the city of Austin and how we can save those too. But this space is special, and it's got a lot of special history to it. It's the first desegregated golf course in the South. It's a National Historic Marker, a registered golf course. And honestly, it saved my life. When I came home from Iraq, it was an affordable place that a veteran golfer could go, and I could play all day. And I would. And I would be there in the morning, and I wouldn't leave until the end of the day. And instead of joining the 22 veterans that, you know, commit suicide every day, I was one of the vets that figured out life and figured out my next mission. I figured out how to be a productive member of society, and I did it on that golf course. So, you know, there's a couple senators out there. There's a couple elected officials, lieutenant governors and governor of Texas. All those people want to save the golf course. We've heard them say it. We've heard them proudly say how much they love the space. We just need them to know that we're not going to just wait for 10 more years. They've been trying to do this since the 70s. They've been trying to push it off, and we'll extend the lease here and we'll extend the lease there. But the reality is we just need for a group to take it over and control it that has its best interest. Right now, that looks like the board that I'm on could easily fit that role. And then we have people like Ben Crenshaw, who are also on that board. And he wants to save it. And he wants to come in with Coore and Crenshaw and redesign the course, make it something that is like a symbol of Austin's pride, something that can bring in people who want to come here. And, you know, like the course used to do that. You know, we have all these people that would come to the city of Austin and they would come play Lyons Municipal Golf Course. And you know, I'm convinced that a lot of that helped those people. Joe Lewis, the boxer, would schedule fights around coming to Austin so that he could play out there, being the first desegregated golf course. You have Ben Hogan played out there as he was recovering after his accident. And then after he plays Lyons Municipal Golf Course, he goes on and does his recovery rounds that are famous, you know. And I wholly believe that his time in Austin with Harvey Pinnock at Lyons Municipal Golf Course helped him recover. Like, can you imagine being able to like pick the brain of Harvey Pinnock? I just know that this course is special. I'm proud to be on the board. I'm proud that there are other people trying to save it. But from the meeting that I had tonight, it's clear that the city of Austin and UT just kind of want to push it down the road and hope that people forget about it. And we're just not going to let them do it. So I appreciate you letting me share that.
Absolutely. It's great stuff. So I wish you a tremendous amount of luck. It would be horrible to think that we're going to lose a course that Hogan, Crenshaw, Tom Kite, Byron Nelson, Sandra Haney, all these great players played out on. And of course, so much to you.
Yeah, that list is so good too. Like, we could fill the list up of people who've gone out there and played. And you imagine, John Bredemus designed Colonial Golf Course, and this is just a theory that I have, but he was in Austin helping with Austin Country Club during the design out there, and I'm wholeheartedly believe that he helped do some of the design with Lyons Municipal Golf Course, because a lot of that design work kind of goes uncredited. A lot of it goes to Harvey Pinnock's brother, Joe Pinnock. But I'm convinced if you look at the layout of San Angelo Country Club, which John Bredemus also designed, there's some very similar stuff out there to Lyons. And you got to wonder, like, they were all built around the same time. You got the same architect going around. Well, that architect is a Texas Golf Hall of Fame architect. And to do anything that he may have had a help in, you want to destroy Lyons Municipal Golf Course would be like tearing up Colonial Country Club. And I just couldn't see somebody doing that. And so, and I know they did just recently tear it up and redo it, but you know what I mean? We can have Coore and Crenshaw go in there and redo it to the 1955 layout. It would be such a gem. I think it would rival the Notre Dame golf course easily. And we could have the University of Texas could have a course that they could practice right in town. No more driving out 45 minutes out into Steiner Ranch to go hit golf balls. You could hit golf balls right downtown and then be right back at class right away. So I think it's a no-brainer. I think the city's going to save it. I just think it's got to keep happening, and the right people need to hear this podcast, because I think if they knew how much I love that space, they'd want to save it. So I appreciate you giving me the chance.
Absolutely. Tim, before I let you go, let our listeners know, how can we stay up to date with all the great things you're out there doing, whether it's following you online or it's on social media?
Yeah, I mean, Team Gestel is where pretty much, if you want to follow me, I share everything I'm doing on Instagram. I also have a Twitter that you can go ahead and follow me. It's tgolfer83, so it'll say Coach G on it, and that's me. So I appreciate anybody who wants to follow along. I definitely think you should follow you along in this podcast. I'm a big fan. Obviously, I've been listening for years, so it's kind of really cool to be on the show. So I appreciate it.
Absolutely, Tim. Thank you, my friend, for taking time out of your night to come and be a part of the show. I hope you'll come back again before too long and give us an update with how things are going both at Muni and then also with all the great things you're doing with the high school kids there in South Lake Carroll. You're a fantastic guy, and I thank you for your service and everything that you've done for our country. And I hope you'll come back and be a part of the show again soon.
I definitely will. Appreciate it. Have a good night.
You too. Take care, Tim.
All right. Bye-bye.
That is Tim Gestel, and the spelling of his last name is G-A-E-S-T-L, and you can follow him at Team Gestel on Instagram, at tgolfer83 on Twitter. Talk about a guy who is passionate about life, and first of all, overcome a lot in his life. Obviously, we thank him for his service to our country and the things that he did out there trying to protect our freedom, and then what he had to go through to kind of get back into the game of golf following his injuries and his service to the country, and how much he means to that, you know, municipal golf course, being a part of that board and saving one of the great golf courses in the state of Texas, if not the country. Look, Ben Hogan, Ben Crenshaw, Tom Kite, Byron Nelson, Sandra Haney played golf out there. It was what Ben Crenshaw said, the 16th hole there was the hardest par four that he ever played. So, you know, it's not just your average run of the mill municipal golf course. It is something that has got a world of wonderful history. So hopefully he and the folks in the city of Austin do what they need to do to save that golf course. But let's scrub all of that away and go back to Tim's service to our country. What a wonderful young man he is. A great service to our country as a member of the 82nd Airborne, a guy that saw what happened at 9/11 and wanted to run into that sort of thing, wanted to give his service, potentially his life, to help our country in a time when everything was chaotic and who knew what was going to happen next. Tim went in and decided that he wanted to make a difference and do the things that he did in the Army. So obviously we thank him for all of those things and for the person and the human being that he is. And then to take all of the lessons that he has learned from the game of golf and take those back into giving back to a municipal golf course and then to the high school students in the state of Texas and become a teacher and a coach and someone who becomes a mentor to those young men and women. It's just fantastic.
What a great guy and someone we all owe a debt of gratitude to, especially as we head into Memorial Day weekend, to thank him for his service to our country, to his service to the state of Texas, for trying to fight for a wonderful municipal golf course and all he's meant to the high school kids that he has mentored along the way. Tim Gastel, fantastic. I look forward to having him back on the show, hopefully a little bit later on in the year. All right, folks, it is time for me to put a bow on this edition of Next on the Tee. I want to send out my sincere thanks again to Tom Patrick, Clark Dennis, and Tim Gastel for joining me this week. Scheduled to join me next week are former LPGA National Teacher of the Year and one of my favorite people on the planet, Cindy Miller, will be back. Former Atlanta Falcons and Seattle Seahawks wide receiver Brian Finneran will join me. Finn has been a wonderful friend over on the football side on our show Thursday Night Tailgate for many years. Very excited that I get to have him here on the golf show. Robert Morris University men's golf coach Steve Schingeldecker will be back. Very excited to have Steve back as part of the show. So much fun the last time he was here. And then we're going to go right into top 100 instructor. My main man, Eric Johnson, will join me as well. Steve and Eric played on the same high school team together, so we'll have them for part of the show together. And the stories are going to be outstanding. I can't wait to have both of those guys join me. So it's going to be a lot of fun, folks. I hope you'll come back and be a part of it with us. Quick reminder that you can find the show available as a podcast just about anywhere you get your podcast content. But in particular, we're out there on the Pittsburgh Tribune review site. Just go to triblive.com and click on sports, and you're going to find the show. The most recent episode is going to be right there for you on the homepage of the sports section. But if you click on sports and then podcast, you'll be able to find any of the episodes from this season available for you right there. You can also find the show available over on Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audioboom, and Player.fm. And as always, my sincere thanks to the folks over at Good Pods for making this show one of their recommended podcasts. So please download their free app and stream your favorite podcast right there on your favorite device. But as I say every single week, my sincere thanks to all of you for being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. I appreciate you all so very much. Until next week, hit them straight, my friends.
Coming down the mountain, I take a breath of sin. Can't tell the day or time, but I know this day will end. On a mission I can't see, they say I am the one. In the end, it's you and me as we ride into the sun. So we ride another big thumb down the drag. We ride another day from the insane.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.